Muriel Gardner, Veal 2. Could I ask you a little more about what training you had in Britain before you left the country? You were saying it was only 1 month. What were you trained to do during that time?
Well, the training was mostly in London, and it consisted of mainly of lectures of people, of welfare officers and what have you, and health doctors and so on, giving you some idea of what they thought the health conditions would be. Of course, they were terrified always of typhus and typhoid breaking out in the conditions of any refugee camp. And so we had lectures on health, lectures on administration. A lot of it was absolutely useless, and we split into groups, and we decided what we should do if there were a party of people were being sent to us from a concentration camp, for instance. We sat in smug little groups, and we decided that we would be given warning, of course, and we would have plenty of time, and we would arrange a reception committee, and we would arrange a little entertainment for them at night, with absolutely no idea of the conditions that we would experience there, that you were never given any indication of when you're getting transported, just descended upon you. And you'll perhaps get 100 people from the concentration camp and you've no idea that they're coming, much less have time to organise any entertainments for them. In any case, they were in no state, in the farthest state they were in, to appreciate any entertainment. So it was all mainly very useless. And then we would go out to places like Aldershot and see army equipment and how to use field ovens if we needed them and so on, that type of thing. All of which, again, was absolutely useless. Because we were only, when we set off from Granville, we were given one field oven which took up half of our truck. And mercifully, all the nuts and bolts fell out of this thing over the jolting of the shell-pitted roads of France, and it was useless. But it operated by petrol exploding inside it in some fearsome fashion. And we've been shown how to use these in Aldershot. So we were very thankful that all nuts and bolts did fall out and we never had to use such a thing. But this was the month's training that we had, which was, as I'd say, largely useless. It was one very useful lecture when we were shown examples of bugs and fleas and lice, and that was very useful when we got to the camp, and we had literally millions of bugs and fleas and lice to deal with.
Did you wear a uniform?
Yes, we had to wear a uniform. Although we were civilians, we had to wear a uniform because had we been captured by the Germans, and we had been in civilian uniform, we could quite legitimately have been shot as spies. And so it was essential that we were put into uniform. And it was essential that we were given ranks. And so my husband was given the rank of major, and I was given the rank of lieutenant. And we were told that it was hoped that the Germans would honour these ranks, not knowing if we were civilians, if we were captured, as we would be treated as prisoners of war. And then it's quite typical of the army. I really don't know how battles and wars are ever won with the chaos that operates, because we did not get our certificates identifying us as major and lieutenant until 3 weeks after the war finished. And so what the Germans would have been done if they had captured us, I don't know. But we were certainly put into uniform, and we were sent to Moss Bros, in London, to Moss Brothers, to fit us out with uniforms, because uniforms, of course, were very short. This was the very end of the war, and the men were not being recruited, and so there was the shortage of uniforms. And we were told that we could use any old bits of uniform that we had. And so my husband said he'd been in the First World War, in the Argyll and Sutherland Highlanders, and so he said, I'm going to use my mother's bonnet. And so he was a bonnet made from the sheep of Lord Lovat's flocks. And so he was the only one in Armagh with a Lovat bonnet. And so it was very amusing. Before we went to Armagh, where we were decked out in our new uniforms, and we were walking down Oxford Street, My husband was saluted by all sorts and conditions of army personnel because he looked rather grand in his leather bonnet.
Yes, I'm looking here at his picture, and I must say it's wonderful, isn't it? So here you were setting off really for the unknown, it would seem.
That's right, yes. And setting off with very little equipment, of course, because the idea of UNRWA was that when we got into Germany, we would be able to requisition anything that we needed. So we had very little equipment. So all that we were given was, there were four of us posted up, and two French drivers, who were charming, typical French types, as it were, and they had to be sent home in disgrace after a bit for their general behaviour. But they were charming fellows and great fun. And we were given two old lorries, old trucks that had seen service in North Africa and been rejected as unfit for further service. So we could guess that they were in a pretty poor state. All was breaking down. And for equipment, all we were given was one typewriter, which was very useful, two shovels, one box of tools, one sack of bread, of which the top four loaves were all right, but all the rest was mouldy when we got down to it, so that was pretty useless. And four poles and a length of green tarpaulin, which caused a lot of amusement and a lot of wonder as to what on earth they could be for. And we could only judge that they were to make a latrine. But as when we got into Germany, we were to find 10,600 people without latrines, it was a little inadequate, to say the least of it. And that was all that we were given. The doctor was given no medicine, no supplies at all, not even a bottle of aspirins. The idea being, as I say, that you could requisition what you wanted. Nobody then knew that we were going to go into a town which had been completely flattened and that there was nothing to requisition, virtually.
What was your impression as you drove? You drove through France into Germany, yes. I imagine. Yes, what was your impression on that journey? You were, after all, going through liberated areas, weren't you?
Yes. It was most evocative. You were part of a long line, as far as you could see. If you crested a hill, as far as you could see in front of you, was a line of army vehicles making their way to the German frontier. It was very difficult. You had instructions that you were not in any way to break the convoy. This is all very fine and very, very easy for the men. It wasn't so very easy for the women. If you suddenly had a call of nature, and I said to my husband, well, it's no good, I've got to go and go find a new someone. So he pulled off the road and he said, well, for goodness sake, be quick, I'm not supposed to break the convoy. So I rushed into a little German tavern. And I rushed in and I said, "Oui, la toilette," and the woman pointed to the corner, and I rushed in and rushed out again, leaving an astonished lot of Frenchmen over their wine, wondering what on earth it was all about. You slowly wove your way over the shell-pitted roads of France, littered with, of course, the debris of war, of tanks and machine guns and in fields and an orchard with a battered field gun, perhaps, and you wondered what sort of desperate last stand some troops had made, German or English, in that orchard. And so it took us 4 days to get across France into Germany, and then, of course, you went through the devastation of the Ruhr, which was quite frightening. The French drivers, to begin with, had put up lewd postcards on the front of their trucks showing Germans in various methods of humiliation and so on to go into Germany full of panache. But when they went through the Ruhr and saw the terrible devastation of it, we noticed that one night they'd taken all the postcards down from the front of their trucks and had the feeling that Germany probably suffered enough without having it running down her throat. And then we made our way across Germany and across one of the Bailey bridges, which had only been thrown up a fortnight previously. So my husband said, I'm going to drive the lorry myself over the Swiss bridge, which he did. Then we went on and we reported at Frankfurt on Main, to the military government there, who had no idea, of course, that we were coming, and so no arrangements had been made for billeting us at all. This is what happens in the chaos of war. And so we had to wait for about 2 hours while the American military personnel turned out of his house, the family of a Nazi general, General von Sobenstern, who had been a general on the Western Front, and his family were turned out of their house and we were billeted in it for about a week. And then we had instructions that we were to go on 8 kilometres further east to a town called Hanau, where there was a huge collection of concentration camp people, tend to be known as displaced persons.
Had you any idea really what to expect as you were driving towards that camp?
Not really, no. We had reported in to the American military government, the government American governor, Major Turner, and he had said that as we've been releasing people from the concentration camps and the slave labour camps, we've been directing them up to some German army barracks outside the town of Hanau. And Hanau had been a lovely old medieval town. It had been the home of the German gold and silversmiths, but it had the misfortune also to be a huge railway junction. And so in a raid of 20 minutes, the Allies had completely flattened Hanau. So there was nothing standing in the town of Hanau except the statue of the Brothers Grimm, which had been standing in the marketplace. It was the birthplace of the Brothers Grimm and the fairy tales. And that was still standing. So whether that was any sort of moral to be drawn about the permanence of literature, one wouldn't know, but that was the only thing standing in Hanau. But on the outskirts of Hanau, there was this huge German army barracks, which consisted of 2 barracks on one side of the road, 2 on the other side of the road, around parade grounds, and then the road petered out into the forest. And so the Major Turner said that we'd been directing these people into these German army barracks. And he said, now that you are here, I will withdraw my troops because I can ill spare them, and you go on and get on with the job. And he said, all I can say is good luck to you. He said, I reckon there are about 10,600 people there at the moment. So he said, we will give you a liaison officer to liaise with us, but otherwise it's your show, he said. So he said, you go on, get stuck in with it, and good luck to you, and that's all I can say. But he said, we are here. If you should get into any trouble, don't hesitate to ask us for help, and we will send it immediately. And so we got in our trucks, and we trundled up the road to find this barracks. Well, as you approached it, the walls were of red brick, but as you approached it, they looked purple. And when you got nearer, you saw it was because there were one mass of flies. You simply couldn't put a pin between the flies, and certainly couldn't take a cup of cocoa from the table to your lips without shielding it with your hands. And when we trundled in with our trucks, of course, there was nobody there to announce it, and you felt completely inadequate. All you saw was a seething mass of humanity in front of you. And as we got down from the trucks, the people gathered around us in curiosity, of course, and some in some fear, because the UNRRA on our shoulder flashes looked rather like USSR, and people feared that we might perhaps be Russian. And so my husband, who was a great organizer, got down immediately from his truck, and he found a man who spoke some French, he told him that he wanted the leaders of all the nationalities that were in this camp bringing to him. And so we could even in a short space of time, fortnight before we had got there, natural leaders had been thrown up, the leaders to whom we had looked for some sort of guidance. And so in a very short time, they brought about 8 or so men who were the leaders of the various nationalities. And he took those men off, and he had what he called a chief's conference. And that proved to be the main spring of the camp from then on. At 10 o'clock every morning while we were in camp, for the 2 years we were in camp, the chief's conference met to decide what should be done during the day and iron out any problems that might happen and so on. So the chief's conference proved to be the linchpin of the camp. Well, then my husband turned to me and he said, you'd better go and see what problems we have with women and children. And so I went off, and I was feeling completely inadequate. I think if there'd been a train home, then I would have taken it immediately, because it felt absolutely useless. What would it do in face of this massive problem and these massive numbers that were confronting it? But I had the good fortune to go into a room which was full of Russian women. And so I began to talk in my dog German, because German was the lingua franca of the camps, because in the concentration camps and slave labor camps, they had not been able to use their own language, and so had had to use German. And so we all spoke this sort of dog German. And so I began talking to the people around the door, and asking them where their hometown was, what their nationality was, what concentration camp they'd been in, and so on. And one elderly woman burst into tears. And I said to her daughter, was this most be here in Mutter? Is she cranky, Basin? And what's the matter with your mother? Is she ill? And she said, no, but you're the first person for 4 years, 3 or 4 years, who's spoken to us other than to shout at us or bully us. And this gave me tremendous encouragement, because I felt that if only I was showing a friendly face and an understanding of the problems of these people, it meant a tremendous lot to them.
What sort of state were they living in at that stage, this early stage? What had been done for the people in the barracks? You know, did they have sleeping accommodation?
Yes, it was in a parlous state. The barracks were in a parlous state, because it had been defended a fortnight before we had got there. It had been defended by the Germans, so there had been a battle there. And so there were piles of old shells and hand grenades lying about in the squares, and 80% of all the windows were out. Many of the rooms were shattered. There was no gas, there was no water, there was no electricity. And when you think that 10,000 odd people had been using the indoor routines for the fortnight, and with no indoor, no running water, you can guess that we didn't smell any too sweet. So it really was in a shocking state. And the American army, of course, was terrified of, as I said, of typhus or typhoid breaking out in these conditions. And so, in the first month, they were seriously considering closing down the camp because it was in such a parlous state.
So,
otherwise, the accommodation was in the blocks of buildings mainly. But of course, the barracks were meant to have a complement of 6,000 troops. When it was a German barracks, the complement was 6,000. And here you had 10,600 people cramming in it. So mercifully, the weather was very good at this period, and so it didn't matter if people were sleeping out in the squares and so on, till you could get them the buildings repaired and housed in some sort of comfort for them.
Could I ask you, you know, as you gradually got used to the situation, what the different groups of nationalities were, or the sort of categories of the DPs, and how you coped with them, you know?
Yes. The camp divided really into three sections, three main groups. There were the people from the concentration camps, and they were in the worst state, of course. And they were, many of them, still in the striped, bluey-grey and white-striped pyjamas of the concentration camps. And they were in a shocking state, really. They were gaunt and emaciated. Many of them bore the scars of the tortures that they'd undergone. So we had one Russian lieutenant who had the marks of red hot irons up both sides of his body where he'd been tortured. There was another man with grooves sunk in his wrist where he'd been handcuffed and then strung up to the ceiling with his feet off the ground, and this sort of thing. So they were in a shocking state. They were so bad that sometimes they used to be sent into the camp from the concentration camps in cattle trucks, because you can get more people to a cattle truck in the First World War, 40 men and 40 cattle. So you could get more into these cattle trucks or luggage trucks than you could into compartments of a train. So they were sent in these trucks. And very often you had to take them down from the trucks in blankets because the bones were so near breaking through the flesh, they were so emaciated. And often when you had discharged everybody from the cattle truck, you would find one or two people dead at the bottom who had not survived the journey. So it was by no means, it was a pretty pathetic business unloading them from say. So those are the concentration camp people.
Yes, would you excuse me, before you go on to the other groups, would these have been Jewish people or otherwise?
well, many of them, we had no Jews in other camps. The Jews were hived off to separate camps, so they were always given, if you like, VIP treatment at the time. So Jews had to be housed in separate Jewish camps. So although very many of our Poles were of Jewish extraction, one has to be careful here because there's a Jewish nationality and a Jewish religion. I mean, you might be a Jew with nationality, but you didn't necessarily be practicing Jewish religion. And so I dare say that quite a number of our Poles and Russians were of Jewish extraction, but were not Orthodox Jews, in the sense that they were not practicing the Jewish religion, but they might have been a Jewish club. But we had no people in camp who were practicing Jews.
And were you getting, regular cattle truck loads of people in?
Yes, they were coming in regularly, 100, 200, 300 a day, and you had no notification that they were coming. So we had to keep a little posse of people who were recruited from the displaced persons themselves. We found two Russian nurses and an old Russian midwife, whom we call Babushka Granny, and they ran the staffing of the station, and then we paid periodic visits, of course, as the new transporters coming in. The concentration camp people weren't known by a name in the concentration camps. They had the number tattooed up the left hand, the inside of the left forearm. So I think that this possibly happened only in the concentration camp of Auschwitz, and I'm not quite sure about this. So I think quite a lot of our people must have come from Auschwitz, but we also had quite a lot from Dachau concentration camp.
Had you been given, during your training, any advice as to how to feed people in that state?
No, I haven't at all. No. Before we go on to feeding, could I just say a word about the other two?
Yes.
So that is one.
Yes, we'll have food separately,
yes,
shall we? Yes.
One third of the camp, roughly, were people from the concentration camps. And another thing about the people from the concentration camps, they all had sort of dark-ringed eyes. They were so gaunt, and their eyes seemed enormous in their faces. And their eyes seemed to stare out as if they were staring at nothing. It was an uncanny experience in those first weeks. And they all spoke in a curious flat monotone, as though all emotion had been drained out of them, and they hadn't sufficient energy to put any expression in their voices at all. It was quite uncanny. They soon lost it, of course, but for the first few weeks, that was the impression that they gave. And then the other third of the camp were the people from the slave labour camps. Now, they were in a slightly better state, because you know the people I'm talking about if you've read Schindler's List or seen the film Schindler's List, because the Germans wanted them to work, they had to provide them with at least the basic sort of ration. So they had been fed much better than the concentration camp. Whereas concentration camp people had no other hope than for the gas chambers. They were for the gas chambers after the Germans had done whatever experiments they wanted on them in the name of military medical science and what have you. They had no other hope than from the gas chambers. Whereas the slave labor camp people were wanted to work. It didn't matter if they worked them to death, which in fact they did, because there were always plenty of other people to supplement them if they fell dead on their task. So the conditions were slightly better than in the concentration camps, but they still were pretty awful. They were shot for the least misdemeanor and so on. But they were known by their names, and they all had a little identity card identifying them. And then the third section were the Polish prisoners of war, and these were in good shape because they had had to be fed according to Geneva Conventions, and they had their army uniforms, and so they were reasonably well clothed, whereas the others were in all sorts of rags. So those were the three main categories of the camp. And then you asked about feeding. Well, feeding was always a problem with 10,600 people. And we, originally, the only method of feeding, of cooking at all, was huge cauldrons which we had in the squares. And you lit fires under these cauldrons. And there was a warehouse nearby, a food warehouse, which had supplied the German barracks with food, and which is now under the direction of the Americans, of course, and that was handed over to us. So we used to send the trucks down each day collecting food. The food was not good, the butter was rancid, and the flour had weevils in it, but nevertheless it was used. And we used to put it all, meat and flour and weevils and butter, in the weevils, no doubt, provided some of the vitamins, into these huge cauldrons and made a sort of goulash which we doled out to them. And that was the way in which we fed them in the very first few weeks. But the one thing about having 10,600 people is that within that number, you've got every craft and trade that you could possibly want. And you've got your plumbers and your electricians and your sanitary engineers, and your job is to find them and use them. And so in no time at all, we got the electricity going and the gas going. And once they were going, you could then open up the little German messes in the various barracks, and they could all have their own national kitchens, and you could direct the food to their national kitchens, and they could cook according to their own ways of cooking, and you no longer had to use these huge cauldrons.
Did you find, though, you know, with these very emaciated, starved people, that you had to be very careful about diet, you know, getting them used to food in the first place?
Yes, you had to. I think that I can't remember that we had later instructions that you had to give everybody 2,000 calories, but nobody told us how to work out calories. And in those days, you weren't at all diet conscious. You weren't used to working out calories. And so you really had to leave it to their own common sense, I'm afraid, as to how they, how much intake of food they took and so on.
Did you have, you know, with these people coming in such a bad state, how did you care for them medically? Because you were explaining that your doctor had no medicines when he went in. So what sort of care could you give them?
The doctor had terrific problems, of course, with the people. And he could do very little in the beginning. But he started to build a hospital, and that was a start. And that came about... because we had an enormous problem within a fortnight of going to the camp. We found when we got to the camp, we saw people walking about dragging one leg, and then they seemed to use the use of their ankles and then of their wrists and then of their hips. And as the numbers grew down, because there was so much malformation of people, we didn't notice it at first, but when, as the numbers grew, when we made inquiries, we found out that before we had got to camp, the night before we got to camp, a party of Russians had broken out of camp, there were no guards on the gate, they'd gone out of camp into the forest where they had been employed as slave labour in a factory making artificial leather and linoleum.